Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm quite excited today because we have with us Dr. Stephen Murillo to tell us about a book that I deeply enjoyed, and I think a lot of listeners will too, titled War and Conflict in the Middle Ages. Now, that's a very straightforward title for something that is quite ambitious and fascinating in its scope. This is really a pretty global history of armed conflict in the medieval period, and we're going to talk about what some of those terms mean, helping us understand kind of not a deep dive into one particular country or one particular war, but what happens if we zoom out? What happens if we look at this more holistically? What sorts of things might we see? So, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Well, I am a retired now professor of medieval history. I taught at a small college in Indiana called Wabash College. I came to that for a long career in teaching after doing my BA at Harvard and a DPhil at Oxford. So familiar with England and love it. And let's see. Before that, I grew up in New Orleans. So I do cooking, and I'm also a painter and cartoonist and various other things. So professional dilettante, perhaps. And how did I get into this book? Well, most of my career, I was focused on medieval military history, and increasingly focused on it in the course of my career in terms of doing comparative global perspectives, comparative history. And what happened was that I had done a book with Polity Press called What is Military History? And that went into three editions, and then working on it through the third edition, my editor, Pascal Porcheron, with whom I got along very well, asked me if I would be interested in writing a book for another series they had on war and conflict in Name Your Chronological Period. And he suggested the Middle Ages for me. And I thought, sure, I can do that. That's easy. I've been doing that all my whole career. I'll just mash a few of my articles together and wrap some stuff around it, and there the book will be. Not. I didn't quite make it in terms of following that plan. And I'm glad, because what I decided is I really needed to rethink the topic from the ground up. What I was assigned was War and Conflict in the Middle Ages, subtitle A Global Perspective. And the global perspective part is what really was a challenge, because, well, partly because the Middle Ages are a European concept, and applying the Middle Ages to the rest of the world is potentially quite problematic. You'd be shoehorning non-European things into a European format and perhaps doing damage to the historical record as a result. So what I did was approach it, as I say, sort of trying to go from the ground up. What can I say globally? What would a global Middle Ages mean? How do I approach the history of warfare and armed conflict across the world in a way that would be coherent and hold together?
Not the simplest task.
Not a simple task. not a simple task at all, but a fun one. And very, very much fit into my general approach, which is to go for big pictures, generalizations, arrive at the sort of broadest truths possible. So my first step was to decide what a global Middle Ages would be. And it turns out that looking at it from a very sort of materialist point of view, in terms of demographics, and in particular the history of diseases and climate, which of course, when I was doing this, the global pandemic had just broken out. So I was like, well, that's relevant. I can define this in terms of pandemics and globalization and so forth, and climate change. So that I thought that would work. And it turns out that in 535, 542, and 547 AD, each of those years saw a massive volcanic eruption. And those combined threw so much crap up into the air that it changed the global climate for a bit. It led to about 100, 120 years worth of what's called the Little Ice Age, the Late Antique Little Ice Age, which lasted from about 550 to 650, in that range, in which temperatures went down a couple of degrees, which is pretty significant, as we know today, from temperatures rising a couple of degrees. And given that all of the civilizations at the time, societies, were either hunter-gatherers or agrarian, that is, based on agriculture as their main mode of production, that had a pretty serious effect. And the impact of that across the globe was to seriously disrupt the patterns of civilization, social organization, and so forth, and therefore kind of brought to an end what you could call the Classical Age, the period of the great empires, Rome and Han China, and so forth. So I thought, well, that's a good starting point. Let's say the Middle Ages start with the Late Antique Little Ice Age. And then I decided, well, okay, so there's a fairly obvious counterpart to that period that could signal the end of the Middle Ages. And that was better known to most people, the outbreak of the Black Death, which in Europe hit in 1348 and lasted till 1351 and killed about a third of the people in Europe. That turned out to be part of a larger sort of pan-Eurasian pandemic involving... It actually broke out first in the 1330s in China, although some of it was visible maybe in as early as 1258 in Baghdad. It was associated with the rise of the Mongol Empire. So there's a pandemic, and it also turns out that coincided with a change in the global climate, because in Europe, again, it's the summers of 1315 and 16, were incredibly cold and wet and non-sunny, and crops failed, and there was widespread famine, and that brought to an end a period that had started back in the 800 or 900s of relatively warm, nice weather. It was a period during which it was possible to navigate across the North Atlantic without running into too much ice. It was the period when the Vikings got from Scandinavia all the way over to North America. It was a period during which agriculture was easy to do because it was nice and warm and sunny and in the places where it had often been not quite so good earlier. And therefore, the population rose in Europe. Now, it turns out that that's part of a larger global pattern as well, that this long period of sort of medieval climate anomaly when it was warm and sunny, applied in a lot of places, and suddenly it got a little cooler and wetter, and it began to get cooler and wetter in the mid-1300s. And that initiated a period that historians know as the Little Ice Age, which lasted from the 1300s really into the first half of the 19th century. The depth of the Little Ice Age came around 1600 or so. You know, if you know Shakespeare and his times, it's true that the Thames froze over every winter in the Elizabethan period, often deeply, because the world was a bit colder, and the climate was less favorable. Now, the problem with that, I thought, there's a nice parallel to the late antique Little Ice Age, that the Middle Ages were born and died in a period of plague and climate change. The trouble is, the latter point is not as decisive as the former. In some ways, it was a bigger set of pandemics, and it was a more serious, longer-lasting climate change. But the societies didn't collapse. They were affected, but they didn't collapse the way classical societies had back in the 5th and 6th centuries. So the more I looked at it, and we can get into more of this later, you know, from a climate and demographic perspective, looking at the numbers of people in the world, I had already worked out big patterns of that for a world history textbook that I wrote for Oxford called Frameworks of World History, where there are essentially three major revolutions in world history in terms of the number of people on the earth. The first was what I call the cognitive linguistic revolution, which happened way back sometime, you know, 10, 15, 20,000. No. I'm getting my dates wrong there. Sorry. Let's say 20,000 years ago. It's earlier than that, but the dates are escaping me at the moment. When people actually developed language and began thinking like modern humans, let's say 70,000 years ago. And the number of people in the world immediately shot up and then leveled off. The next change was the agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago. And when people started farming, the number of people in the world rapidly increased for a while and then leveled off again. And then the third change was the industrial revolution. Around 1800, the number of people in the world shot up. In some ways, we're still in that sort of population increase of the Industrial Revolution, but it's beginning to level out already. Demographers think that the world population will be flat by about 2050, 2060. So we're in the leveling off. We're starting to enter into the leveling off phase of these three major periods in world history, the hunter-gatherer phase, the agrarian phase, and the industrial phase. And I realized that when you want to define the end of the Middle Ages, it's the Industrial Revolution. It's that so much was constant throughout the agrarian era that the Middle Ages is simply the last phase of the agrarian era. Therefore, my Middle Ages go from about 540 to 1800-ish.
I was going to raise this at the end, but in fact, because you've mentioned it already, that timeline gets rid of a period that we might otherwise or maybe habitually call the early modern period, right?
Yes, it does, intentionally. the early modern period was, again, an invention of European historians because it was in some ways invented by Renaissance humanists in Italy in the 15th century who looked back to the classical Greek and Roman era and thought that they were leading a rebirth of classical knowledge and classical ways of doing things, thus a Renaissance. And the Renaissance became the beginning of the modern world for them. And historians, European historians ever since, have sort of just fallen into that idea that the Renaissance humanists did as a mode of self-advertisement, really, and have identified the period after the Middle Ages as the modern, except that the farther you got into it, and especially once industrialization started to hit, the more I had to say, okay, it's the early modern. There's lots of stuff here that's foreshadowing things to come. And I think that's simply mistaken. If you look at, start with the easy one, politics. one of the things that's true about the agrarian era across almost all the major polities, states, and societies that were organized politically is that they were organized around a unitary political leader. There was a king. Kings were natural in the agrarian era. And the early modern era is still an era of kings. And the modern era, we don't live under kings. Kings, you know, we may have threats of authoritarianism still, but it's an era of mass politics and democracy, ideally. And the early modern era doesn't look very modern in that way. And that's true also, it's the economically, the great subsistence mode of production was farming. It's not true anymore. You know, the American population, I think, is 6% farmers, and it's industrialized agriculture, so we can feed ourselves and other parts of the world, and this is true all over the place. And industry replaced farming as a major mode of wealth creation. And in that way, also, the early modern period doesn't look very modern. It looks like more like what came before than what came after. And in all sorts of ways, if you break it down, in the Industrial Revolution was really the turning point. That's what created the modern world. I think modern is a sloppy term itself, because everybody's living in their own modern age. But if you want to sort of define what constitutes the modern world, it's a lot of stuff that was brought about by industrialization. And therefore, early modern as the last period of the agrarian era before industrialization hit has never sat comfortably with me. And I prefer calling what is usually called the early modern period, in, at least in European history, 1500 to about 1800. I prefer generally calling it the late agrarian era. But for the purposes of this book, I was happy to say, yeah, that's the late Middle Ages. That's the really late Middle Ages.
Well, very helpful to give us a sense of the scale of time that the book covers. So very useful to have that as we kind of continue. But while we're in defining things, could you define some other totally uncontested terms for us, like, you know, war?
Yeah. So the assignment was war and conflict, and that's more than just war, and which is a good thing, because in the Middle Ages, it making that definition gets a little hairy sometimes. And this is because there has been armed conflict in human history for a long time. Now, one of the things that I think is true, and I've made this argument in a number of places, is that war, which I came to define as something like organized human violence against other humans, actually hasn't been around forever. It's not built into us genetically. It's a product of the same developments in some ways that led to the rise of agriculture, and the rise of agriculture then cemented it in. And that's because agriculture and settlement and people living in one place led to disputes about territory that had to be settled in some way other than one group simply moving away, which is what had happened before then, and that continued to happen in areas where settlement was not the main mode of living. That if there were a conflict, the easiest thing to do is move away and reduce the conflict. But once you've got people committed to a particular area where their farms are and where they've built their houses and where they've accumulated some wealth, it's a lot harder to move away. And therefore, if there's conflict between neighboring groups, it's more likely to develop into an armed conflict like what we would call war. And in addition, once you've got agriculture and the accumulation of wealth and settlement, you tend to get specialization of economic and political roles in a human community. And one of those specializations early on is, well, if we need to make emergency decisions about like fighting, we need a leader. And this is where kings come from, where chiefs come from, where war leaders come from. And once you've got that division, it turns out that going to war is good for the war leaders because it allows them to increase their authority. Whereas going to war might work for the community as a whole, but it's also expensive and risky and dangerous. It's risky at a personal level for the leaders, but leaders, as part of a class of leaders, tend to benefit from war. Everybody else tends to suffer from it, but the leaders are the leaders, so you get war kind of baked in to the organization of these human communities. So war, for me, is organized human violence against other humans. And the organized hides or it contains the idea of political organization, because that's the only way to organize people for mass fighting, is to have a community that's organized hierarchically. And therefore, war tends to be primarily, not exclusively, but primarily a state-level activity. Now, there are a lot of times when states are pretty minimal, but it's still that sort of organized political activity becomes part of the definition of war. Does that answer the question?
Yes, no, that really does. Because now we have an idea of when we are and sort of what we're looking for. So based off of that, what were available to, for example, these sorts of leaders of political hierarchical societies if they wanted to conduct warfare in this time period with the physical constraints, the geographic constraints, the political constraints available? What were the strategic practices that they could draw from?
Well, it depends on what kind of armies they could raise in the first place. And that, again, is a product of political organization. And it's also a product of the technologies available to people to conduct violence. And this is where we're still in a sort of materialist analysis of the physics of war, the physics of medieval warfare. And what they could do was raise troops. Now, if you've got a small group of elite warriors who are holding the society together, which mostly means that their job is keeping the peasants in place and doing their job of raising food, you can use them as an army, but there's not a whole lot of them. So it's also possible then to conscript some of those farmers, make a sort of massive block of infantry soldiers, and that's okay. It's what early Mesopotamian city-states did, was, you know, blocks of infantry with a few elite soldiers leading them. Not particularly effective. The first big addition to the toolkit for conducting conflict is to bring another species in, and that's horses. Horses were domesticated sometime between like 4500 BC and 3000 BC in this little area of the Central Asian steppes just north of the Black Sea by a group of people who spoke Proto-Indo-European. And the success of domesticating horses as a way of adding to the muscle power available for making war is indicated by the fact that Indo-European languages now are the most widely spoken language group in the world. And it all started in that little area of the steppes north of the Black Sea. So what that tells us is that if you want to get work done in the agrarian era, you've got three sources of power: wind power, water power, and muscle power. And water power and wind power aren't real useful for warfare because you can't concentrate it enough into decisive sort of explosions of energy used to bring something down. And therefore, muscle power is going to get almost all of your work done. And that's human muscles throwing spears, wielding swords, pulling a bow, and shooting arrows, or it's horses carrying people and sometimes trampling other people, but more often simply adding speed and carrying ability to your armed forces. So horses significantly increase the ability to make war initially through the invention of chariots, and then as actual true cavalry, that is, men riding on horseback and wielding weapons from horseback. So at that point, you've got infantry, you've got cavalry. The third addition that becomes part of the arsenal of warfare is that one of the things people do when they settle down is they want to protect themselves, so they build walls. Cities were always surrounded by walls. That was partly to keep the workforce in, but it was partly to keep enemies out. Probably more important to keep the workforce in, frankly. But it was important to keep the enemies out. And what that meant, fortifications were effective because they represent a bunch of accumulated labor power. You build up a wall, you've had hundreds, maybe thousands of people carrying stones, laying bricks, putting it all together. Once you've got that wall there, that represents a lot of labor power. And to knock it down, you need a lot of labor power on the other end, but you have to apply it more quickly than you did in building up the wall. So people start inventing catapults, trebuchets, with whatever kind of siege engines they can, other ways of bringing down walls. And it always involves human muscle. Counterweight trebuchet is a nice invention from a bit later in the Middle Ages, where you load up a giant basket of rocks, and that acts as a counterweight. You drag that up using human muscle and then let it go, and it's at the one end of a lever, and the other end slings a giant stone against the enemy wall. But quicker ways of applying some energy to the problem are like mining under the wall, digging under the wall and making it collapse, or trying to burn the city down. Fire is a source of energy, but it's a pretty uncontrollable one, so it's not real useful in warfare until it's turned into gunpowder, and that's not until after 1000 AD in China, and it spreads slowly from there. So to answer your original question, what rulers have is this selection of types of troops: infantry, cavalry, engineers, artillerists, whatever you want to call them, to put against the enemy's same collection of troops. And all of them are tending to wield personal weapons that, again, are muscle-driven. They're swords, they're spears, they're bows and arrows. And what that means is that medieval warfare is close together, it's face-to-face, it's very bloody, it's loud, it's confusing, it's not a pleasant place to be. Well, warfare almost never is, I suppose, unless you're at one end of a drone attack. But it put a premium on having your units cohere, work together, and having your units obey a single commander. So medieval battles tended to revolve tightly around what the commanders were doing, whether the commanders survived, that sort of thing. And this is true all over the world. See, this is I was aiming at definitions of warfare and violence and how weapons worked and so forth. The reason I went to physics is that physics is universal around the globe. So the same constraints applied in China as in Europe, as in South Africa, as in Central America. You go around the world, it's all the same constraints on what kinds of weapons and what kinds of troops you could have, with the exception that horses weren't everywhere until after the Spanish got to the Americas in the 1500s.
No, that's very useful to understand the scale and the scope of these constraints and what they lead to. You briefly mentioned gunpowder there, and obviously developments like trebuchets and things like that. Is there anything further you want to say about how the technology of warfare shaped conflict, both kind of at the big picture level, but also in terms of operations, the operational level and the strategic level?
Yeah, good. That's a great question. Yes. Because your sources of power are wind, water, and muscle, that applies not just to hacking at an opponent tactically, but it's also the constraints on mobility, transport, movement. So most medieval warfare was not only in tactical terms close in and bloody and loud and so forth, like I said, but it's also the range of armies, how they could march, was not fast. You know, infantry armies can, if they're good, can manage maybe 15, 18 miles a day. It's more likely that they're doing, you know, 6 to 8 miles a day, especially if they've got to set up a camp and break camp at the beginning and end of the day. In most warfare, between settled, sedentary societies, that is, societies politically organized around cities, the goal of a campaign was to go get the enemy's city, which could mean various angles of approach. You'd have to be able to march there or sail there. Cities themselves had to be located such that you could supply them, because their cities in the agrarian era tended to be demographic sinkholes. More people died in cities than were born there. They grew by people coming in from rural areas. So you'd aim at the city, and if you took the city, you had political control of the area that the city was in charge of. So that's a sort of basic strategic principle, is go take the cities. The trouble is sieges are difficult and expensive and costly in terms of manpower as well as money. So you wanted to maybe try and outmaneuver your opponent in such a way that you cut him off from his own city. Or there are lots of different ways to approach this. But the ultimate goal was to take the enemy cities. Now, the exception to that is areas where there aren't cities. And the biggest area of that, that it can be described that way, is the Central Asian steppes, where once horses were domesticated, that became the home to Central Asian nomads, like the Turks and the Mongols and so forth, who combined horsepower for mobility, and not just for riding, but the horses would pull carts that had their tents and all that stuff. All their possessions could be moved at an instant. So there was no place, if you were attacking a nomadic state, there was no place to attack. You had to try and attack the enemy forces. And they were generally, if you're approaching with an infantry army, they're a lot quicker than you are. They can avoid combat. They can choose the time and place of combat. So those two worlds were very different from each other and had a difficult time attacking each other. Now, the nomads could ride through and plunder the settled areas, and did fairly frequently. If they wanted to take a city, that was a bit harder, because you can't take a city by charging a horse into the wall. The horse won't do that. And in fact, that's effective infantry, is if the infantry makes itself into a sharp, pointy wall, horses also won't charge into that. So you've got to like scare some of the infantry away before you can conduct an effective cavalry charge. But the nomads could often, you know, by surprise, take a city, conquer, you know, defeat all the armies so there's no one defending the city. But once the nomads conquered an area like that, at least some of them had to become sedentary to live in the city and rule the area. And that tended to split the nomads. Some of them went home and said, "This is sedentary people are weak and perfumed and effeminate, and we don't want to be that. We're going back out on the steps where we can be manly men. Therefore, there tended to be two different worlds. There was the steppe nomadic world of Central Asia, and then the sedentary worlds that surrounded it. But the combination of horsepower and firepower that nomads deployed, and they had these compound bows that were made from a combination of bone and sinew, and were short but very powerful. So mobility and firepower is an awesome combination in military history. The nomads had a ton of it. The Mongols at one point probably controlled 70 or 80% of all the horses in the world. That's a lot of muscle power. That's a lot of military might. They were the military powerhouses of the medieval world, the steppe nomads. The fortunate thing for the surrounding sedentary areas is that the nomads most often fought themselves, fought each other. And therefore, it was only when they were when they could get together, form a massive coalition, that they were a real threat to the sedentary areas. And that didn't happen very often. One of the things that would put nomadic coalitions together was if they were near a big, rich sedentary society, the sedentary society could protect itself by paying tribute. Say, don't attack us. Here, we'll give you piles of silk and metal and stuff. And the nomadic leader who could lead a raid and get that stuff could then get more followers and build up a bigger coalition and get more tribute and build up a bigger coalition. And then you end up with something like the Seljuk Turks or the Mongols or some nomadic group that conquers a wide area of sedentary society.
That is very interesting to go into more detail about. Thank you for kind of elaborating that problem of the physics and the muscle and how that all plays out on this level of different states and how they interact. I want to sort of link, I suppose, what we've been talking about in terms of what these conflicts were actually like, the politics needed to make them happen, with what you were saying at the beginning of kind of the extent to which things are or are not changing during this period. You talk in the book about how you understand the wars in the early Middle Ages as being a process of medievalization. What do you mean by that?
This is my book falls into two parts. The first part is all about this physics stuff and the basic conditions of warfare and how wars were conducted. The second part traces the change over time that happens for societies conducting warfare between 540 and 1500, 1800, whatever your endpoint is. The first thing I'll say is that in terms of that physics, over the course of that period until 1800 or so, in fundamental terms, the physics didn't change. You did add gunpowder, but gunpowder throughout this period remained like, it's better than catapults or trebuchets. It's more powerful, but it's still fairly close range and somewhat limited. And in every other way, in terms of logistics and weaponry and so forth, there's small incremental change, but there's no revolutionary change. Once you've introduced horses, that's the biggest revolutionary change in warfare until the Industrial Revolution. So we're going to go up to industry, and industry is going to give us a whole new suite of things and more powerful explosives and blah, 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 and that'll be the end of the Middle Ages. But to go back to the question about medievalization, the problem facing societies just after the late antique Little Ice Age that had sort of totally disrupted production and political organization and shaken things up is that as the climate became less extreme, people were trying to rebuild their concepts of what societies were. And one of the ways that, well, if you put a bunch of humans together, one of the key ways that they organize themselves for organizing themselves is through discourse, is through talking and exchange of ideas. And my approach in the second half of my book is to treat warfare, armed conflict, as a form of discourse. It's a particularly bloody and conflicted form of discourse, but it is a form of discourse. It's a way of making claims, claims on someone else's land, claims on of political power over people, or a way of resisting those claims. But it's also a way of creating identity, because people fight in particular ways, and the way they fight often is an advertisement of who they are. A nice example would be the Pictish people who lived up in Scotland in the around 1000. Their warriors advertised who they were. They were Picts because they painted themselves blue. They appeared almost naked on the battlefield, painted blue. And so, okay, that's the Picts. We got that message. War and conflict, war and armed conflict is a way of asserting claims, defending against claims. It's a form of discourse. And my analysis of the period from the end of the late antique Little Ice Age, somewhere in the early 600s, until maybe depending on the time on the part of the world, because this is not all parts of the world move at the same pace. People were building new societies, and they did this through warfare, through making claims about political power, staking out identities, and when those came into conflict, if they were close neighbors in a near area, the conflict would often result in what's called in other terms acculturation. That is, the two sides would be speaking the same language in warfare terms. They'd have the same ideas about what constituted fair play, what the stakes of victory were, what you could do with captured enemies. Those are cultural political questions that could be worked out on the battlefield, and the more people fought each other, the more they sort of fought the same language. And my contention is that as different areas of the world fought these post-classical wars, they created their own new worlds through warfare, through conflict, that created not just new states and polities, but new cultural identities, and cultural identities that were tied much more tightly together with their political organization than I think had often been the case in the classical world. And so the process of medievalization was the process of creating smaller, often more thoroughly militarized societies with a closer relationship between the rulers, who were fairly small scale, and primary production on the land, and therefore created polities, states that turned out to be more resilient, more coherently organized than classical states had been. Empires like Rome were vast and impressive and could raise vast armed forces, but they were internally pretty heterogeneous. You know, the difference between a Spanish or an Iberian in the western part of the Roman Empire and a Syrian in the eastern part of the Roman Empire were pretty significant. And the medieval polities tended to be smaller, more culturally coherent and unified. And that was created by armed discourse, by warfare as discourse, of people talking to each other, by fighting each other, I'm not recommending this. So it's a bad form of discourse, but it is a form of discourse. and it resulted in the creation of new worlds that were not classical anymore. They were medieval. So that's the process of medievalization.
In that process, or one of the outcomes of that process you talk about in the book, is that there are now, as you said, these early medieval worlds that are not just more kind of connected within themselves, but you also talk about sort of more interconnected with each other. If we sort of look at where we're at by about 1300, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And certainly by 1000 or so, the early Middle Ages are giving way to a sort of central Middle Ages where a number of areas have established fairly broadly cultural identities. Often that was building on some classical foundations, but transformed by the whole process of medievalization. So you've got Western Europe, you've got Northern India, you've got China, Japan becomes an offshoot of that at some point. And those areas are broad enough that there are variations among them, but there's also intercommunication between them. And then those areas are also connected to each other via long-distance trade, commerce, sometimes warfare. But by that point, the cultural identities established in the early period of medievalization were firm enough that when different cultures met, they didn't simply assimilate to each other. There was cultural conflict that was recognized at the time. This is a different people. A good example is the Crusades, where these still somewhat barbarous Western European Franks went over to the Middle East and fought against Arabs and other Muslims. And they had different ways of warfare. And initially, they didn't really understand each other, but they developed an mutual understanding about warfare anyway. They still maintained different cultural traditions and cultural settings, but it was perfectly possible just to assert that a whole lot of political organization was sitting on top of peasant societies whose attitude might have been explained by the who, meet the who, new boss, same as the old boss. This happened in the Middle East. Christian lords would come in and be granted an area of territory as their fief, as their way of paying for their military service. And that meant instead of ruling over Christian peasants, they were ruling over Muslim peasants. And that was okay. That worked. They developed some understanding of each other without necessarily changing each other's fundamental sort of cultural identity. So by 1300, it's a more complex world. It's these little different areas of medievalized societies had linked up enough that you can start speaking about a medieval world. That's the world that then suffers the twin disasters of the Black Death, the second bubonic plague pandemic, and the beginnings of the Little Ice Age.
Okay, so let's move to that, because you mentioned that these medieval societies are more resilient than the classical ones. Mm-hmm. And if we're now at a point of having a medieval world, the way that we can talk about to some degree a classical world, those are two pretty big challenges you mentioned. And yet, as you said right at the beginning of this, they don't lead to the collapse of the system the way that the classical age did pretty much collapse. So can we do a bit of kind of compare and contrast if we look at, say, how these classical societies reacted in maybe the 500s with how this medieval world reacted to quite similar challenges?
We can, and the advantages are all on the medieval side. Again, this goes against the sort of common conception, Rome was so mighty, but Rome broke apart. Other medieval worlds sort of broke apart. Now, part of Rome survived, and East Rome became the Byzantine Empire. But the Byzantine Empire remained sort of oddly fragile and ultimately disappeared, where most of the other medieval worlds that were created through the process of medievalization stayed, if not together politically, at least together enough culturally that they're kind of still there today. They're the building blocks of modern world cultures. So what happened was that despite the scope of the disaster, again, I'll talk about Europe, but this is true in a lot of places. The Black Death created mass mortality. When a third of the people in a civilization dies, you don't expect it to necessarily carry on and just keep functioning. But they did. The kingdoms, I mean, in 1348, England and France were well launched into the Hundred Years' War. So they'd been whacking at each other. And in 1346, England defeated France at the Battle of Crecy. And these big battles, organized stuff. Yeah, okay, so 1348 to 51, there are no campaigns because everybody's like saying, oh my God, what's going on? But it's not long after 1351, when the pandemic dies down, that both states are raising armies again and launching campaigns. And it's like, wow, all that meant nothing? You can just keep doing this? And that's a testament, I think, to the organizational and cultural coherence that these places had, that you give them a demographic shot to the jaw that would have leveled any classical society, and they just stagger a bit and then go back at it. And that's true for the entire medieval, none of the medieval world really collapsed. The Byzantine Empire was a sort of holdover part of the classical world. And it fell eventually to a different medievalized society. Well, got caught in the conflict between the medievalized Western European society and the medievalized Islamic societies of the Near East. And of the three major powers fighting in the Crusades, the Byzantines were the one who did not survive. And they had not gone through that process of medievalization. They sort of held on to classical modes of state organization, which means that some classical worlds survived, but in general, the record was not good. So economically, politically, culturally, the medieval world proved resilient enough that they could face a larger catastrophe than it actually hit the classical world, and keep going. And this is why as I was writing the book and trying to figure out what I was saying about this, why I kept having to push the end of the Middle Ages back, because it's like, no, the conquistadors, they're pretty medieval Spanish warriors, and they're going to go and conquer the Aztecs and the Incas. And okay, so that's the medieval world meeting the American world, which had gone through their own version of the climate disaster and so forth. They got their own version of the demographic disaster when all the Eurasian diseases came with the Spaniards and wipe them out. So where's the dividing line there? Well, maybe it's the discovery of two new continents, and this was in that way a new world, but that's just a fact. How you approach those continents, the political organizations that emerge on them, at least in South America and Central America, Spanish set up vice royalties, meaning vice kings, kings are still there. It's mass sort of peasant agriculture. I don't see a lot of difference. You know, you start talking about new political organizations in North America and a little corner of it in 1776, growing out of new political organizations in England that had emerged in 1688. But generally, it's still continuous cultures. It's developments that are not revolutionary in a quick, decisive sense. The world of 1900 was so vastly different from the world of 1800 that you can see a revolution there, where the world of 1800 was not that vastly different from 1700 to 1600 or 15 going back. I do this in the book with the last illustration in the book is a reproduction of Jacques-Louis David's portrait of Napoleon crossing the Alps. And it's captioned "Very Late Medieval Warrior." And if you look at the painting closely, Napoleon's on his horse. The horse is rearing up. And they're standing on these rocks. And David has painted into the rocks a couple of names, three names. The names are Annibal, that is Hannibal, Carolus Magnus, that is Charlemagne, and Bonaparte. And what that tells me is that Jacques-Louis David thought, yeah, that's a reasonable comparison. Napoleon to Charlemagne to Hannibal, all famous crossers of the Alps, militarily, on horseback and on foot, fighting recognizably similar enough wars that Napoleon gains by that comparison. If, on the other hand, another crosser of the Alps in a major war, if you try to compare George Patton to Napoleon, it's like, that doesn't make any sense. The changes are so vast that it doesn't enlighten things any, whereas comparing Napoleon to Charlemagne and Hannibal actually does. It makes sense. So this is the extended Middle Ages up through Napoleon. That's a demonstration of the resilience, the consistency, the cultural continuity of the medieval worlds. And this is global. I know the European case is best in some cases, I can tell you about Chinese and Japanese versions and a bit about Indian versions of this. And it's a global phenomenon, and that these medieval societies coalesced. The one part of the discourse, I'm sorry, I'm going to do a quick tangent here. I'll try and make it quick. The one aspect of the Middle Ages cultural construction that wasn't military discourse was religious. The military discourse coincided with the spread of the salvation religions, as they're called in world history. That is, devotional Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam, in that order. And those become a central part of the cultural cohesion of medieval societies, but those are always intimately connected with warfare. I mean, the Islamic explosion was a religious-military fusion, and medieval Europe was, as the Crusades showed, a military-religious fusion. And that was had been pretty central. That sort of military religious fusion was built into the caste system in India, and Buddhism was perhaps the least comfortable with this. But you still had medieval Tibet was an aggressive Buddhist empire. It's like the two, you can't really separate the two. So sacralized warfare, there's the discourse that makes the Middle Ages.
Well, even just in that answer, there's kind of two big ideas that might be key takeaways for readers. Skepticism of the tag early modern and the importance of religion as being part of this warfare medievalization process. Are those the two big lessons you want readers to take away from this book? Are there other things that you hope they come away with?
Oh, that's a good question. As an historian, I am aware of the present and lessons perhaps for the future, but for me, it's really a process of analyzing what happened in the past, understanding that better. Yeah, I think understanding that process of medievalization as a combination of war as discourse and religion as discourse and the blending of those two languages is one of the things I'd really want people to take. Especially that notion of war as discourse, it can be a very valuable way to analyze conflicts. I think the other lesson unlike the many places in the classical world, which were a bunch of very loosely connected unipolar worlds. There was like Rome, and there was China, and there was the Mauryan Empire. So unipolar worlds, and that has in some ways remained a kind of political science ideal. But what the medieval world teaches us in this sort of discourse is that multipolar worlds can also be vital, conflict-ridden, but you don't need a unipolar world to achieve world peace. Maybe there's other ways of going about it. And that's a very tentative lesson, because I can't claim that there was much world peace in the Middle Ages. There was a lot of warfare. It's like, no, that's a bad lesson, Stephen. That's not going to work. But anyway, I think the war is the discourse involving armed conflict and religion is my key lesson.
Hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense given what you've told us. As a final question then, is there anything you might be working on since this book was completed or currently working on you'd like to preview?
Sure, I'll do a little self-advertisement for it, guys. It'll give me another reason to stick to my deadlines. I'm currently working on two different books. One of them I'm co-authoring with Jeremy Black. It's a history of European warfare from about 540 to 1920. And you'll notice that 1920 crosses the industrial line and goes well all the way into the 20th century. And that's significant because the theme of the book is to look at European warfare in that period from the perspective of continuities, what stayed the same. And that's by contrast with, and as a sort of argument against, the recent emphasis in a lot of military history literature on military revolutions and how, oh, this changed everything. And it didn't. There were underlying continuities. And in any history, there's always underlying continuities and visible changes. And our sense is that the balance in terms of emphasizing revolutions has swung too far that way, and we want to pull it back towards, well, don't forget, there's a lot of in really fundamental, interesting continuities there. So that's one book. The other book I'm writing, the same editor that got me into the War and Conflict book has got me into a book whose title keeps changing around, but it's essentially going to look at 10 sieges in world history. Sieges are this really interesting intersection between military history and urban, economic, political history. Cities were at the center of so much that sieges were pretty important. So I'm going to look at 10 sieges through history, starting, I think, with Alexander's siege of Acre in 332 BC, and going right up through, I forget what my last one is, I think it's the siege of Sarajevo in the 1990s. I might go farther than that, I've forgotten now. And sort of simply tracing an impressionistic world history through this history of 10 different sieges that happened in different areas of the world in different times. So that's my two book projects.
Well, best of luck with both of them, and of course with the associated deadlines.
Yeah, thank you.
But while you finish those up, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled War and Conflict in the Middle Ages. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.